God's goodness and God's power come into question at a time like this. And I think it's important for us to go back to the scriptures and see how the Bible's very clear declaration of both his goodness and his power. I'm going to read next excerpts from Isaiah chapter 40. You will see them on the screen behind me. Would you stand, please, in honor of God's word? Go up on a high mountain. Lift up your voice with a shout. Here is your God. See, the sovereign Lord comes with power, and his arm rules for him. He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart. Who has understood the mind of the Lord or instructed him as his counselor? To whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? God sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary. Young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. You may be seated. I have not had opportunity to verify every detail of this story I tell you, but I will tell it to you as it was told to me. Craig Scott of Columbine High School was in the library this past Tuesday with his good friend Isaiah when two students entered that room armed. In front of Craig's eyes, Isaiah was killed, and the gunman moved on to kill others. Craig and some of the others pretended to be dead until the gunman had left the room. At that, Craig stood and pleaded with the other students to quickly get up and to flee the room. Hearing a plea for help, he reached down to assist Casey Rugsager of our church. And after much difficulty, they reached safety. And from that safe position, Craig asked them all to pray and to pray for their friends, and particularly to pray for their own brothers and sisters who were still in the school. And for the next many minutes, they prayed and they watched as one after another of those for whom they had been praying came out of that building. And as each one came out, Craig would comment from time to time to the others, "See how God answers prayer." But Craig's own sister did not come out. She was killed on Tuesday. Some made it out alive. Others didn't. Craig prayed, and it looked like his prayers were answered, except in the most important prayer of all, the one for his own sister. How do you make sense of that? How do you put that together? What are you supposed to think? And since prayer and God have been brought into this discussion already, where is God in all of this? The tragedy of the Columbine, or at Columbine High School this week, raises a host of feelings and thoughts and questions. And this experience has impacted everyone in this community to varying degrees. I believe there are many, that is, those most directly affected, who are still just numb. They are not yet asking questions. They are not angry. They just don't feel. They are just right now in the midst of the heaviness of grief and sadness that leaves them numb. If you are one of those and you are here today, I say to you, it is not our desire at all for you to somehow engage in the discussion that is going to come next. We're not asking you to think about a great many things or even necessarily to believe a lot of things. we would say to you, we want to simply come alongside of you and love you, and if it's appropriate, to hear from you and to even hug you. Following the service this morning, there are going to be people down here at the front very willing to meet with you. Or if you need the privacy of the prayer chapel, go there, please. But though not everyone is directly affected by this, everyone is affected. And for many of us, maybe most of us, questions do come to mind. Some are fearful. This week I've heard several parents tell of how their children have expressed fear over going to school, even going outside, going to sleep at night. Even for adults, those willing to think about it, there's an undefined insecurity that hovers about like a cloud. Is life truly that fragile? That suddenly and quickly it is over? Does an inattentive driver drift across the traffic lane and into my lane even as I'm heading home from church today and snuff out my life? Life certainly isn't as certain today as it was even 5 days ago. When we dare to ask the question, it comes down to something like this. Is anybody in charge? Is anybody in control of what's going on? Is there any rhyme or reason to what is taking place? Three possible conclusions come to mind to me with that question. First of all, this conclusion, I'm in charge, at least of my own life. Though we often act like we are in charge of our own lives, we quickly, I think, dismiss that conclusion when we are slapped in the face by the reality of capricious evil and untimely deaths. This past week, I officiated at the funeral of a 43-year-old man of our church. 1 week earlier, he was at work and feeling perfectly okay. Believe me, at that funeral, there were a lot of sober men. I don't think any one of them is today feeling in charge of life. There's a second possible conclusion or answer to the question, is anybody in charge? And that answer is that we are simply the victims of fate. That is, no one is in control. Nobody's in charge. Things just happen. Two-word bumper sticker that you've often seen, I'm sure, on cars proclaims that philosophy. Stuff happens. But that conclusion not only doesn't account for the evidence of good that we experience every day, it only leads us to two possible conclusions, nihilism or hedonism, despair or devil may care. Fatalism is, to me, the most tragic conclusion of all. But there's a third option. The third conclusion to the possible, to the question, is anyone in charge, is this. Yes, someone is in charge. And that someone is God. But if, with all the evidence for the existence of God, we choose to believe in him, we are then faced with another problem. Whether it's the death of a 43-year-old husband and father, or the carnage that is taking place in Kosovo, or the tragedy at Columbine High School, we are forced to ask the question, what kind of God is this who is in control? If he's in charge, what kind of God is he? Living in the cold shade of the Columbine tragedy, it appears that either God is good, but he is not powerful, meaning God feels dreadfully sorry for what has taken place to students and teachers and families, but he is powerless to stop it. Therefore, you are left with a powerless good God, or he is powerful, but he's not good. He had the full ability to stop what was taking place, but he didn't care. In which case, you are left with a powerful, evil God. Those appear, and I emphasize that word appear, those appear to be the only two options, but the Bible contradicts that appearance. The Bible declares over and over again, and it demonstrates over and over again, that our God is both all-powerful and good. But when death and senseless evil invade my life and my community, how can I believe that? How can I hold to the sovereign goodness of God and the sovereign control and power of God in a world that is so filled with evil? I believe there are at least three things we can do in wrestling with that issue. What I'm going to say next is not a formula. Please don't understand it that way. I'm not for a moment pretending that what I'm going to say in the next few moments is in any way easy. But the first thing I think we must do if we are filled with questions, filled with doubts, filled even with anger, is that we must wrestle with God. The last thing in the world we need at this point in time are pat answers. And the other last thing we need in the world are no answers. Pat answers don't deal with reality. And no answers head us right down the road toward the despair of fatalism. Don't go to either of those extremes. I'm so impressed with the men and women of the Bible. When life looked and felt impossible, they wrestled with God. They shook their heads, they cried, they complained, they even accused God. But they did not ignore him. In the Old Testament, there's the account of the woman named Naomi. It's in the book of Ruth. Her husband and sons were dead. Her livelihood was cut off. She was in a foreign country. When she finally made her way back home, she said to her neighbors, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara or Bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." Do you hear her accusations? She's wrestling with God. Elsewhere in the book, she makes it equally plain that she believes fully in the sovereign control of God over every aspect of life, including her own. Elsewhere in the book, she over and over again fully affirms her belief in the full goodness of God. And she finds no contradiction between believing in the sovereignty of God and the goodness of God and accusing God, even at the same time. Job wrestled with God. The psalmist David wrestled with God. 4.5 years ago, Flight 427 left Chicago bound for Pittsburgh, but it crashed. It was 43 seconds from the time they knew there was a problem until 132 people were dead. Pastor Thad Barnum spent nearly 2 weeks working that crash scene, coming alongside of the coroners and the others who were cleaning up. One day as he approached a man unfamiliar to him, the man said to him before Thad even got there, "You want some advice, bud?" The man didn't even know Thad's name, and before Thad could respond, the man went on, "Don't make it easy. Don't tell us everything is going to be all right. This place is a hellhole, so tell it like it is. We are going to carry away from here things that will be with us for the rest of our lives. Do me a favor. When you get in your pulpit next Sunday morning, don't let God off the hook." That's good advice. Don't let God off the hook. Wrestle with him. You don't have to make excuses for God. God does not need pat answers. God can take care of himself. Tell him how you feel. Tell him how deeply you feel it. But do not run away from him. Wrestle with him. How can you believe in an all-powerful and yet all-good God? It starts by getting in his face and wrestling with him. Secondly, I would ask you to look. That is, look at the rest of the evidence. You know, in the midst of the pain, in the midst of the confusion, in the midst of the immediate results of a particular situation, it looks like God has failed at either being good or being powerful. But look at the rest of the evidence. His power is amply demonstrated in the scriptures. Power to create the heavens and the earth. The power to perform the miracles that he performed. But most of all, his power as demonstrated in the resurrection from the dead of Jesus Christ. He is so powerful that he defeated death itself. Could anything else make his power more obvious and certain? Now, there's so much more that could be said about that, but I move on to his goodness. His goodness is amply demonstrated in the things that we enjoy in life. His goodness is demonstrated in the newness of each morning, in the friends and family members that we love, but most of all, his goodness is demonstrated in his death for you and for me. I love this quote from John Stott. In the context of which we are speaking, he said, "I could never believe in God if it were not for the cross." I'll tell you why he said that. It's from a play of his entitled The Long Silence. It's a long quote, but maybe if you see it and hear it, you can stay with me. He wrote, At the end of time, billions of people were scattered on a great plain before God's throne. Most shrank back, but some near the front talked heatedly with belligerence. How can God judge us? How can he know about suffering? Snapped a pert young brunette. She ripped open a sleeve to reveal a tattooed number from a Nazi concentration camp. We endured terror, beatings, torture, death. In another group, a black boy lowered his collar. What about this? He demanded, showing an ugly rope burn. Lynched for no crime but being black. Far out across the plain, there were hundreds of such groups. Each had a complaint against God for the evil and suffering God permitted in his world. How lucky God was to live in heaven, where all was sweetness and light, where there was no weeping or fear, no hunger or hatred. What did God know of all that man had been forced to endure in this world? For God leads a pretty sheltered life, they said. So each of these groups sent forth their leader, chosen because he had suffered most. A Jew, a Negro, a person from Hiroshima, a horribly deformed child. And in the center of the plain, they consulted with each other. At last, they were ready to present their case. It was rather clever. Before God could be qualified to be their judge, he must endure what they had endured. Their decision was that God should be sentenced to live on earth as a man. Let him be born a Jew. Let the legitimacy of his birth be doubted. Give him a work so difficult that even his family will think him out of his mind when he tries to do it. Let him be betrayed by his closest friends. Let him face false charges, be tried by a prejudiced jury, and convicted by a cowardly judge. Let him be tortured. At last, let him see what it means to be terribly alone. Then let him die. Let him die so that there can be no doubt that he died. Let there be a great host of witnesses to verify it. As each leader announced his portion of the sentence, loud murmurs of approval went up from the throng of people assembled. And when the last had finished pronouncing sentence, there was a long silence. No one uttered another word. No one moved. For suddenly all knew that God had already served his sentence. Who can deny his goodness? Who, understanding what he has done, could possibly deny his goodness? And who, when you look at the amount of evidence, can rationally deny his power? But then how do we account for the tragedies we see around us? I think the answer, in this case, is in a word. It's perspective. You see, when we look at the death of a loved one, we are tempted to think, as does the rest of the world, that that's it. It's all over. We look at tragedies that happen in our world as if they are somehow the last chapter of the book. We are so limited in our perspective, so unknowing of the future, that we are sorely tempted to despair. I know that I have shown you this book in the past, but it so well captures this concept that I want you to see it again. It's called Billy and the Attic Adventure. I suspect there are some of you a lot older than me who won't be able to see these words, but you hang with me, okay? There once was a little boy named Billy. Billy loved to explore things. One day when Billy's dad came down from the attic, Billy got an idea. Billy climbed up the ladder into the attic. And he found all sorts of fun things to explore. One thing was a leather aviator cap. Too big, but great fun. But when Billy tried to come down from the attic, his foot slipped. Billy could barely hang on. "Mom! Dad!" Billy screamed as the cap covered his eyes. "I'm right here, Billy," said Dad. "Just let go. I'll catch you." "But I can't see you," Billy cried. "You don't need to," said Dad. "I can see you." So Billy let go, and he fell right into his father's arms. It has to do with perspective. Whose perspective do you have? What I'm going to say next, I would not say to those who are currently most deeply affected by this present situation. It's not because what I'm going to say next is not true, but it is a truth that one must adopt before tragedy comes, or a truth that can only be heard sometime later when the pain has begun to subside. If we will alter our perspective, if we will, as it were, step up alongside of God and be willing to see through His eyes, we will know that what was to us the worst possible experience is, in fact, within the sovereign and good plan of God. In our pain and in our limited perspective, we balk at that concept. It even sounds cruel, but the Bible teaches it over and over again. Joseph in the Old Testament said it this way: others meant it for evil, and it was, but God meant it for good. James of the New Testament said it this way: consider it joy when you face trials, because God uses that to bring spiritual maturity. Not only do I ask you to wrestle with God, not only do I ask you to look at all of the evidence for His power, His goodness, and from His perspective, but lastly, I challenge you to pray. Prayer is an exercise of the will. Prayer is a choice to believe that God is listening. Prayer demonstrates a willingness to be proven wrong in my perspective and my feelings. Prayer is God's method for accomplishing His purposes. Prayer is an expression of dependence on God. Prayer, therefore, is an act of faith. Having wrestled with God, having looked at all the evidence, I finally come to a point of making a decision. Will I trust God, or will I follow my pain into the despair of fatalism? I do not pretend for a moment that it is easy. The struggle, I believe, is intense. The pain is immeasurable. And though I do not compare my own situation, I have spoken to you in recent weeks of my own struggle with trusting God. I am keenly aware that I have not here, nor could all of the questions possibly be answered in a situation like we have before us. It is impossible for us to fit all of the pieces together so that some pretty picture emerges. Instead of answering all the questions, however, we are called to come to a person, to come into the presence of the Lord Jesus, and to trust Him. It was told to me that Scott Craig, who prayed for the safety of the others and his sister, said with the confidence that only God can give, "My sister is with the Lord. I know I will see her again." I do not think that Craig could have said that glibly. That statement, given the context, could only be said because Craig has wrestled with God. Craig has looked at the other evidence, and Craig has chosen to believe God. Do you? Will you?